It's starting to feel like an election season. New year, new policies, new resignations. In the last month, three senior government MPs have declared they will not contest the next election.
He will not recontest.
While this was a personal decision for Kelly O'Dwyer, which is why she's decided to bring an end to her political career.
It's pretty disappointing that Bill Shorten would cast a slur. He should have just wished Kelly O'Dwyer well.
There's rumours of more to come. But as the Prime Minister flew through Queensland this week, he urged political watchers not to underestimate him. Scott Morrison is determined to fight this election on the economy, arguing a Bill Shorten government would drive Australia into recession. The bottom line will certainly be top of mind for most voters. But as this stinking hot January draws to a close, another issue burns.
There's been another major fish kill in the Menindee Lakes in New South Wales.
Yesterday we saw all-time records being broken across South Australia.
Quite a few of these are dead from yesterday, but this is a lot more. There's been a stack die overnight.
More dead and dying fish spread across the surface and banks of the Darling River at Menindee.
A mass die-off of fish, record-breaking heat waves, sheep dying from heat stress. It reminded Australians that we still don't have a comprehensive national approach to tackling climate change. From the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, this is Please Explain. I'm Tori Maguire. Joining us later is environment and energy correspondent Nicole Hashem and senior reporter Peter Hannam to examine how a new wave of conservative independent candidates plan to ride this summer's heat waves all the way to the federal parliament. But first, we'll swing to federal editor and Canberra bureau chief for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, Bevan Shields.
Hello, Bevan speaking.
Hello, Bevan speaking. It's Tori.
Hello, thought it would be you. How are you going?
Good, how are you?
Who is on the unofficial campaign trail with the Prime Minister. Where are you?
At the moment, I'm sitting in a Brisbane hotel room, which feels slightly different to my desk in Canberra. I've spent the last couple of days following Scott Morrison around Brisbane and the Brisbane suburbs. It feels to me as though this is almost the first week of the unofficial election campaign, and Scott Morrison isn't really here in Queensland to win seats. He's here to save them because the government doesn't have a majority in Parliament anymore, and the Prime Minister only needs to lose just one seat this election and he'll no longer be Prime Minister. So the strategy in Queensland at this point is to sandbag their marginal seats, and there are plenty of them in this state. Of the top 10 most marginal seats for the coalition, five are in Queensland, so it's very, very important here, and it's very important that they do what they can to not go backwards here.
So he spent some time with Peter Dutton in his seat, hasn't he? Tell us about that electorate.
It was quite a moment, really. Obviously, after the August leadership spill, Scott Morrison did reach out to Peter Dutton despite their differences and kept him in cabinet, but we haven't seen a huge amount of them together since. So today we saw them in full campaign mode in Peter Dutton's marginal seat of Dixon, which is really at risk of being lost at the election. And they're out and about being one big happy family, talking about road infrastructure announcements. I thought my observation was that the Prime Minister is actually quite a good campaigner on the ground, possibly better than Malcolm Turnbull was in the 2016 election. He's pretty relaxed. He's pretty casual. He takes the good with the bad. We had quite a funny moment this morning where he was taking a picture on the side of a road where the government was planning to plough some money in, and people were screaming abuse out the window, and that was all fine. That didn't worry him too much. And then sort of within half an hour, we were at a coffee shop, a very impromptu stop, and he was chatting away to some of the customers, and they all seemed to like him a lot, respond very well to him. So on the ground, I think this is probably something that Labor knows as well. On the ground in the election campaign in May, he probably will be quite effective.
What's his demeanour like? Because his social media presence is very kind of ochre, you know, I'm an ordinary bloke kind of, almost to the point of caricature. Is he like that in real life with people, or is he a bit more relaxed?
He is, I think, and I think he. I put that question to him the other day, and he basically said, "What you see is what you get with me. You might not like it, but that is me." I think that's an interesting strategy because there are a lot of politicians in Canberra who have a very different public persona to their private one. We all whinge and complain about politicians who aren't themselves, and the Australian public are pretty good at have pretty good detector at picking that up. So I think he's prepared to if being himself means that not everyone is a fan. I think he's prepared to cop that because he possibly does appreciate that there is some value in authenticity.
So if he is a good on the ground campaigner, he's not going to stop, is he? I mean, we're at the end of January now. The election will be in May. He's just going to take every single opportunity to be out and about, isn't he?
That's right. I mean, everyone sort of has nightmare stories from the 2016 election campaign, which was 8 weeks, and nobody ever wants to go through that again. But in a way, the election really starts now up until late May, so it's even longer than 8 weeks, really. There are a couple of weeks for the government in Parliament. Parliament can be pretty ordinary for the government. They seem to have a uncanny ability to shoot themselves in the foot whenever they're back in Canberra. So they'll be very keen to get that over and done with very quickly and get back out on the road. I think that goes for the cabinet as well. The full cabinet was here this week and they've been out and about today as well.
So you're actually travelling with the Prime Minister and his team, and I'd love to know what the mood is like. Are they feeling optimistic? The Prime Minister this week said to people, you know, don't underestimate me. I am a fighter. I'm not going to let this election go. Is that enthusiasm infused his whole team?
They're under no illusion that they're behind, but there are still some people, and there aren't many, but there are still some who think they will be able to effectively perform a miracle and turn it around and win. I'm afraid to say there aren't many of his colleagues who believe that. Privately, a lot of his colleagues concede defeat is coming, and it's just more of a question of whether it's an enormous landslide or whether it's something that's respectable. But you won't hear Scott Morrison reflect between now and May on what might happen in the event of a defeat. He's not going to entertain it. He wants to win it. He's going to throw everything at it. But it's an enormous task. And really, they all know that they're starting this election contest well behind.
Speaking of his colleagues and their attitude, some of them are throwing their hands up in advance of the election and saying, we're not contesting. And there could possibly be still more to come. But that's not highly unusual, is it?
It's not unusual, and Bill Shorten has tried to get some mileage out of this and says that the 7 or 8 coalition MPs who've put their hand up to retire at the election, that's effectively rats leaving a sinking ship. The uncomfortable fact is that in 2013, when Labor was heading for the rocks and Tony Abbott was about to win that election, 15 Labor MPs gave up their positions in Parliament. That was the most of any party since 1990. So this happens. People leave. People look ahead. They look at the electoral reality. They look at their own personal circumstances. Some even look and wonder whether if they're a drag on the vote, they might pull the pin and go themselves to give the party a chance with a fresh face. But I think personally, I think we shouldn't be concerned about MPs leaving. Renewal is good. We don't want a parliament with people sitting in there who don't want to be sitting in there. And we also don't like politicians who leave mid-term and trigger by-elections that cost hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars to the taxpayer and really divert the attention of both the major parties during that, from governing during that those by-election contests. Mm.
So some of the MPs who are refusing to go are now facing challenges from very well-funded, qualified, articulate independents who would have been straight out of Liberal Party central casting, you know, economic conservatives who don't like the union agenda of the ALP, who are running against sitting MPs on purely on the issue of climate change, effectively.
Yeah.
We're seeing that in against Tony Abbott with Zali Steggall running against him. Julia Banks has now said that she is going to run against Greg Hunt and has pretty much outlined that she's in favour of most of the coalition's economic policies but wants action on climate change. Is that message getting through to the people running the coalition campaign that they are under threat from traditional Liberals who think that their climate and energy policy is not up to scratch?
They're very aware of it. They're worried about it. There are a lot of people who are worried about Warringah particularly and the potency of the climate change message in that electorate. That electorate, for people who don't know, it's on Sydney's North Shore. It's a beautiful area. It's surrounded by beaches, by harbours, by national parks. People in that area, they're surrounded by the environment. So it is a big...
And some of their houses are falling into the sea.
That's right. So they are aware of it, and the government is very aware that they are going to have to do more on climate change. I think we will see in the April budget there may be some extra money for certain programs to deal with it. But at the same time, Scott Morrison will not embrace, I don't believe, a higher emissions reduction target than they've already set. But that you may well see that they're going to spend and spend possibly quite big on certain programs and funds that may go some way to reducing emissions.
So finally, Bevan, the campaign is underway. What are your plans? You're the Canberra Bureau Chief. You've got to run our coverage. How are you planning on getting our journalists out and about during the election campaign? Are they going to be on the Prime Minister's plane or doing other things?
We've spent a lot of time thinking about this because the media is not above criticism, and there was a lot of criticism, I think, of the media after the 2016 campaign that was warranted, that we weren't really as in tune as we could be with some of the issues that the public was talking about. I think the biggest one is the Mediscare campaign that Labor ran. I don't think people really appreciated on the ground the impact that was having. So what we will try to achieve in the election campaign is a good mix between making sure we spend time on the leader buses with Bill Shorten and Scott Morrison and holding them to account and observing how they're campaigning, but charting our own course as well and making sure that we get off those buses and away from the politicians and the messages of the day and talking to the voters and asking them what's important to them. I think we also feel that there's a role to play for the media in not just covering the news and analysis, but explaining to our readers the competing policies in nice, clear, concise, plain English that people are able to really understand, give them something that they can take into the ballot box with them.
Bevan, thanks so much for your time and enjoy the rest of your trip through Queensland.
Good to talk. Thank you.
Bevan Shields is the Federal Editor and Canberra Bureau Chief for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age.
Hi, Ross Gittins of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. There's a whole internet of facts and opinions about the economy out there. How are you supposed to know what to believe and what not to believe, what's worth your attention and what isn't? If you're short of time, my advice is find a news outlet and commentators you know you can trust and don't fret about the rest. If you know you can trust us, we'd like you to support us by subscribing today.
Every summer, it seems the debate about how to approach our changing climate reignites. This summer, however, the heat and its impact on our environment all feels a bit apocalyptic. Distressing as it all is, the policy responses seem confused. To help us understand what's happening in our climate and what we're going to do about it, we're joined by Peter Hannam, who writes on environment issues, and Nicole Hashem, who is our environment and energy correspondent for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Peter, I would like to start with you first. You have spent the early part of January out west, far west New South Wales. Can you tell us where you went and why and what you saw?
So look, we made two trips in a course of about 10 days. First out to Menindee, which is in the far west of New South Wales, south of Broken Hill. And we went out there because a mass fish kill had erupted on the lower Darling. So up to 1 million fish had died there. And in fact, we've had a follow-up just this week, possibly even bigger. So quite a massive die-off of fish in that part of the river. And we can obviously look at some of those causes later. But we also wanted to see other parts of the Darling. So we went up to Bourke, Telpy, those parts of, if you like, the middle Darling in New South Wales, and had a sense of just how other parts of the state are coping with the big drought, lack of water, and even the irrigation industry there pretty much starved of water.
Let's start with the fish kill, because that's the images that we've seen. That was a huge story over the Christmas and New Year period, looking at these, you know, 100-year-old fish dying in the Murray. Has it been cleared up? What has caused this incident?
Yes, so as you say, look, many of those fish had clearly survived previous droughts. 10, you know, decades old Murray cod, more than a metre long, quite massive and quite a special fish for anglers in Australia. So what had actually happened, it looks like there's been just so little flow of fresh water into the Darling that you've got big blue-green algal growths over large stretches of the river. In fact, quite a few rivers in New South Wales at the moment. And so what only needs to happen is some, for example, shock, change of the weather from a very hot period to suddenly a cool one, which is what we've had now twice in 3 weeks, which leads the blue-green algal to die. And when it dies, bacteria eats it, sucks up what remains of the oxygen in the waters and already quite low levels. And that just gets beyond the threshold of fish that have been struggling with the heat of the water and some other stresses, and that just knocks them over. And so we've seen these two events where basically thresholds of fish, some of them have survived for decades, have just been crossed and then they die and float to the surface.
So we have seen a lot of people pointing their fingers at the irrigation and cotton industry, but it's not that simple, is it?
Well, look, the irrigation, the whole Murray-Darling Basin plan, the $13 billion plan that's been in force since about 2012, has been trying to address what looks like quite serious over-extraction. Now, irrigators are obviously some of the biggest extractors. And whether, for instance, the cotton farmers are due particular blame is probably by itself unfair, because farmers are trying to get the best economic return for the water rights that they have. So if almonds, as in further, you know, in the Murray area, that's a more productive use of that water, that's what it's shifting to. Elsewhere it's rice, maybe somewhere it's dairy or grapes, for example. But the question about whether irrigators have too much is definitely a live one, partly because different licenses have been given higher levels of security than were probably warranted in large parts of particularly the Barwon-Darling River. And we're seeing some of the consequences of that now basically coming to the fore.
Nicole, politically, this is a very fraught area because it's a federal issue. It's also a state issue. For the coalition, it's very complicated because the Nationals might have a different position on water rights and the way they are managed than their more inner city Liberal counterparts. What's been the federal political response to these horrifying images for the start of the year?
Well, I think you're right in that it is complex and it does cross jurisdictional boundaries, the federal government has been quick to point out the state responsibilities in these areas, because the Murray-Darling Basin plan is so complex, it is very hard for the general punter to work out, you know, who, if anyone, has done wrong here. But I think the shocking images that we saw and the fears that raised amongst voters about drought and climate change and what's our future going, is this our future? It did force the federal government to act, And, you know, they've put some money into looking into what's gone wrong and also into probably better monitoring the health of fish.
So apart from the shocking pictures, the other thing that has sort of shocked us all out of our Christmas and New Year reverie is just the heat. I was in Adelaide last week when it was more than 47 degrees in the suburb that I was in. And I went outside and I felt like my eyeballs were hot and my eyeballs were possibly going to melt. Peter, out west where you've been visiting at Bourke, it's like that quite often. How are people coping with the current temperatures and the drought out west?
Well, as you say, some of these areas are often particularly hot. And so when Adelaide, Sydney, Melbourne are hot, then these places are hotter still. In Bourke, you know, they were having days in a row above 45. For example, Menindee got to 48 last Friday. And if you're in those places, the you know, people obviously duck for cover during the day. But one of the interesting parts that we've seen during this particular heat wave is just how hot it stayed overnight. And in fact, when we were up in Bourke, we were just in the area where Australia was setting the highest minimum temperatures on record, above 36 degrees. In other words, in the middle of the night, you know, 11 o'clock, it's still 40 degrees out there. The air is, even in the darkness, almost burns. It's that really ridiculous kind of heat. But even water is connected to this because a lot of the older air conditioners are evaporative coolers. They call them swampies. So they need water to take the heat out. But the water they're getting from the taps is as hot as if you were turning on the hot water tap. It's quite ridiculous. So that doesn't provide much cooling at all. And so these old air conditioners are basically pumping hot air around. So that doesn't give you much relief at all. And it just reinforces the kind of stresses. It's not just the bright sunlight that's draining people. It's also just how hot it is at night and how hard it is to recover.
So, Nicole, we've had the images, we've had the heat. This is now front of people's minds. This is definitely going to be a significant issue in the election campaign. Where is the federal coalition on this? Last year, they tried unsuccessfully to get the National Energy Guarantee through the party room, and it effectively killed off another prime minister in the way that energy policy tends to do to the coalition. The current treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, was the one who was trying to get that through and didn't succeed. Now they have really focused all of their rhetoric on energy and bringing down energy prices and increasing energy reliability and stopped really talking about emissions and climate. What is the coalition's climate and energy policy going into the federal election?
So as you said, Tori, the federal government did dispense with their National Energy Guarantee late last year. It was a source of great discontent within the coalition, and eventually they just couldn't get it together. So Morrison has now put the focus on prices and reliability, but it really does leave the energy sector without any kind of emissions reduction target. But overall, the government is cutting emissions across the economy in line with the Paris Agreement, which is a 26% reduction by 2030. But even our international peers, such as the OECD, have said in a report today that Australia's efforts so far aren't even on track to meet that fairly modest target. The government would also point to a number of other instruments. They've got the Emissions Reduction Fund, which essentially uses taxpayer money to pay polluting companies to reduce their emissions. They've got the Clean Energy Finance Corporation and ARENA, which help invest and develop emerging renewable technology. But as the OECD says, these approaches are really piecemeal and they're not going to bring Australia to the big contribution to the global effort that is needed.
And what about the Labor Party? What's their policy?
Labor has a 45% emissions reduction target across the economy, which is obviously much more ambitious than the government, but it's still at the lower end of what experts, including the government's own climate change authority, have said is needed if we're going to do our bit to keep global warming below catastrophic levels. But having said that, they've set it at 45%. They've also got a 50% renewable energy target by 2030, as opposed to the government, which is going to, well, is not going to extend the renewable energy target after it peaks in 2020. And interestingly, Labor has also picked up the remains of the National Energy Guarantee. They're going to use that framework to build on emissions reduction in the energy sector. And I mean, I think they believe that given that the government devised this framework, that it offers the best chance for a bipartisan consensus on climate policy.
So, Peter, this federal election is going to be about a lot of things, obviously, not just climate change and energy policy. However, we are seeing a trend of otherwise conservative independents running against Liberal sitting MPs on a platform of climate and climate action. Karen Phelps actually won the by-election in the seat of Wentworth after Malcolm Turnbull was ousted by campaigning very heavily on this topic, this and refugees. But now we've got former world champion skier and barrister Zali Steggall, who's put her hand up to run against Tony Abbott in the seat of Rowinga. And now we've got a new candidate in Melbourne who has put his hand up to run against Treasurer Josh Frydenberg, Oliver Yates. Tell me about their message.
Look, their message, and I would say there's probably going to be some more independents emerging. I would recommend Hughes and McKellar as the next two, where you'll see emerging talent, if you like, people who are liberals, who adopt or promote or support many of the liberal policies apart from climate, seeing this is the big failing, if you like, of the Liberal Party and the coalition in general. So for those three, they've obviously hit a nerve, if you like. There's quite a lot of general concern, you could say, about climate change, summer, a drought, and which they probably record December heat, record January heat, likely nationally, all kind of come together to reinforce a sense of concern, and we're not doing enough. And I mean, they would say, and Oliver Yates coming out of the Clean Energy Finance Corp, I mean, he's battled, originally the Abbott government had tried to axe that institution, which had been set up in the Gillard government, and it was only saved, ironically, by Clive Palmer, blocking it in 2014 in the Senate. So in a sense, he's been fighting the Liberals for some years, even as a former Liberal Party member. So what they would be pointing at is that if Australia has signed up, so for instance, to the climate policy at Paris and a 26% reduction in emissions from 2005 levels by 2030, we actually have to be on a downward slide at some point. We actually have to be reducing emissions, and they've been rising since about 2013 when the coalition government came into power. And it's really only in the electricity sector that there's been any sort of hint of hope, if you like, in this area. And that's mostly because the price of new renewable energy, particularly solar, has been falling so dramatically. And batteries are coming also on a similar path. And it's interesting that, for instance, Labor is supporting or plans to support, if they get elected later this year, 100,000 batteries in homes as part of a million battery installations by 2025. What you will find probably over time is emerging responses. On the one hand, pumped hydro, which is providing a sort of dam storage to pump water up when you've got surplus renewable energy and let it go when you need the extra electricity. That is, there's, apart from Snowy 2.0, which was Malcolm Turnbull's pet project, if you like, if that does get up, that'll be on, tap from about 2025, and that will have an enormous potential to back up, electricity during times when renewables are low. But you'd have to take other kinds of measures, including creating markets to reward consumers when they power down. And that's starting to emerge, a so-called demand response. And you just need really the policies that encourage that and, if you like, have government get out of the way and let the market resolve it.
Nicole, what is it your sense about how the coalition is dealing with this political threat from within their own sort of heartland? People who are opposed to Labor's economic policies are generally conservative but want greater action?
Well, judging by responses of late from the government, you have to think that they have still got a bit of a tin ear on the desire of voters to bring about some change on this issue. The government will repeatedly hark back to their Paris target. They say they're on track to meet it. They've got the policy settings right. That seems to be in contradiction with a whole lot of authoritative bodies and also the view of the general public. People are becoming increasingly sceptical that the government has this under control. I mean, obviously the government will seek to criticise Labor's policy, calling it a wrecking ball through the economy. And I think there are some questions Labor needs to answer. I don't think it's exactly known yet how the energy market will evolve to make sure supplies remain reliable under a much greater renewable energy share. But we do need to remember there are a lot of states and regions overseas that have wind and solar at really high levels already, and the lights aren't going out. So it can be done. And I think Labor also needs to clarify how the 45% emissions reduction target across the economy will be reached. The focus is always on energy, but cutting emissions in transport, cutting emissions in agriculture is very complex and expensive. And I think until Labor produces some firm policies and modelling in that area, then I think it's a vulnerability for them in terms of the government's economic argument.
Mm. So who's funding these independents and these campaigns? I mean, GetUp has made it clear that they have made this a priority for the campaign, but is there any other money behind this push?
Yeah, well, the candidates themselves say that there are, the general punter, the general disaffected Liberal voter, are backing them strongly. And there are a lot of Liberal voters who really do feel like they haven't been listened to, very frustrated and quite aghast at the level of pull that the right wing of the party has over the policy direction of the government. They may be willing to reach into their pockets to counteract that.
Hopefully by the time the election rolls around in May, things will have cooled down a little bit. It is possible that this topic will, diminish in the voters' minds as it's no longer 47 degrees, but it's certainly top of mind for everyone at the moment. So thank you very much, both of you, for joining me, and we will check back in with you close to the election.
Great, thanks.
Thank you.
Peter Hannam is a senior journalist at the Sydney Morning Herald. And Nicole Hashem is our environment and energy correspondent in the Canberra Bureau. Thanks to Nicole Hashem, Bevan Shields and Peter Hannam for joining us. If you know someone who would enjoy this week's episode, make sure you share it with them. Or better yet, grab their phone and get them subscribed to get new episodes every week. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Support the work we do. You can find the link to sign up in our show notes, or just pop subscribe Sydney Morning Herald or The Age into your search engine. This episode was produced and edited by David Escort and Nicole Presell. Technical assistance from David McMillan. And Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Tori Maguire. Thanks for listening.